Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. In this week's episode, we'll hear from Elliot Cohen. He's the Director of Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies. He makes the case for hard power's continuing role. He's in conversation with Steve Krasner of Stanford University. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience, and the broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our moderator, Stephen Krasner.
And so it's really a pleasure to be here and to be able to introduce Elliot Cohen. We've actually known each other for a frighteningly long period of time. We served together in government for about a year. He's now the Robert E. Osgood Professor of Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins University, which sits right, for those of you that know Washington, sits right in the middle of all of the most influential think tanks in the city. He received his BA and PhD degrees from Harvard. He taught at Harvard at the Naval War College and then joined the faculty at SAIS in 1990. He was counselor at the Department of State, which is a kind of title which means you end up doing important things that the Secretary of State asks you to do. And the title itself actually really does carry some weight. He served in the U.S. Army Reserve. He was a director in the Defense Department's policy planning staff and directed the U.S. Air Force's multi-volume study on the first Gulf War. He's written a number of books, the most recent of which we're going to speak about tonight, The Big Stick, The Limits of Soft Power, and The Necessity of Military Force, not a position that many people have the courage, I would say, to take, which I'm sure he's experienced already. So I'm going to ask Elliot a few questions, which I hope are provocative, and I'm sure that you'll have many more provocative questions. So the basic argument in the book is that it's not just enough to use soft power to speak softly, but there are times that the U.S. needs military force, and there are times when military force is really indispensable for the U.S. But it's also evident, I mean, that we can see that the problems that the country's facing, they're difficult and complicated. It's not always clear exactly how military force could be used effectively. So I thought I'd start by asking you questions about a number of the very difficult issues which we now confront. So let me begin with North Korea, which has been in the news for the last couple of weeks. So what's the combination of military force and other kinds of pressure that we might use effectively in North Korea? And why is hard power so essential?
So let me first begin by saying how happy I am to be here and to be on the platform with Steve Krasner, one of whose accomplishments was teaching a young undergraduate named Elliot Cohen when you were an assistant professor at Harvard. So we really do go back a long way, and you deserve all the blame for what resulted.
You turned out way better than most of my students.
So North Korea. Well, there have been a number of functions of military power. The first, which is actually one of the most common functions of military power, is just preventing something really bad from happening. Since the Korean War ended in 1953, the United States has kept varying levels of armed forces on the Korean Peninsula, roughly 25,000 throughout most of the period, with a military commitment to South Korea. And at the end of, how many years is it now since then? It's over 60, almost 65 years. South Korea is a vibrant, prosperous democracy, and there has not been another Korean War. And I don't think that would have happened without the fact of American military power there. So that's already a major accomplishment. The immediate issue, of course, is what do you do about the North Korean nuclear program? And I guess my feeling about it is that all along, there have really been only two possibilities. One is the United States would undertake some sort of preemptive attack to try to destroy that program, or you find some way to live with it. Now, no administration, including the one that you and I were both part of, thinks that that's an acceptable alternative. And so the Clinton administration, the administration we were part of, the Obama administration, all tried to come up with some alternative to that. In our case, it was the six-party talks. And, you know, Secretary Rice's hope that you could negotiate a final end to the Korean War, which would involve the denuclearization of North Korea. Every administration says, I know what the lever is. We'll go to the Chinese. The Chinese have the ability to coerce the North Koreans if they want to. And I think all those were doomed to failure. And they all failed. And the current effort to get the Chinese to really put the screws to the North Koreans will fail, too. Fundamentally, because the North Koreans have a very powerful interest at this point and an emotional commitment to having nuclear weapons. And the Chinese are willing to accept a nuclear North Korea as the price of not having a unified Korea that is more or less aligned with the United States. And they're not willing to be our to do our dirty work for us. So then, you know, you are left with that binary choice. My view would be that at the end of the day, you're better off, regretfully, living with North Korean nuclear weapons, but continuing to put that regime under as much pressure as you can, largely through sanctions, through soft power, understanding the limits of all that. Using military power to contain the threat, so that means pretty heavy investments in anti-ballistic missile systems, and having as a last resort the ability to preempt. When I say the last resort, I mean if, you know, in some future situation we think the North Koreans are actually about to throw a nuke at Tokyo or Los Angeles or San Francisco, as horrible as it would be, I would rather that we launch some sort of preemptive attack to stop that if it's in the works than to accept this city or Los Angeles or Tokyo being incinerated. What troubles me about the current set of circumstances, which goes to, a larger problem I have with the Trump administration, is this is obviously a very delicate situation. There are a lot of ways in which it can go wrong. I have a great belief in human stupidity and folly and ability to make mistakes. And I think it is not inconceivable that we could stumble into a conflict. And I don't think that would be a good idea for all kinds of reasons I'd be happy to go into.
So maybe you could talk about that a little more. And especially, I mean, what seems to me a central dilemma for the U.S., which is that Seoul is within range of a lot of North Korean conventional armament. And they could kill 100,000 people. I think there are 12 million people in the metropolitan area in Seoul. So could we actually act unilaterally, even if you're thinking about a possible scenario when there's a missile on the launch pad? We might not know exactly where it's aimed. We might not know if they're going to shoot it off. I mean, is it really... given the potential retaliation against the South, you know, how effective could we be in using military force under those circumstances?
Well, a couple of answers. One is that there's the technical question of, you know, what kind of warning time do you have, and what can different munitions do, and what kind of delivery platforms you have. And I've spent enough time pulling apart an actual air campaign to know that there's a level of technical information and knowledge that you have to realistically assess the prospects of that sort of thing, which we don't. I don't have clearances anymore. And if I had clearances and I knew that, I wouldn't say anything anyway, so it'd be sort of pointless. So that's, you know, I think that's one issue. There's a technical judgment. The second point that I would make is this, that in any of these problems, there's a difference between the analysis, the kind of rational analysis that you and I can conduct here, sort of weighing these imponderables, and the visceral reaction of a president who has just been told there's a missile on a North Korean launch pad, we think it's a nuclear weapon, it has the potential to hit Los Angeles, and we think that there's a 60-40 chance that they're about to shoot it off. I think under those circumstances, any president will say, even if it's, you know, a 1 in 3 chance that we can stop this, go ahead and do it. And that'll be, you know, so the our sort of rational analysis really won't be relevant in those circumstances.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So let me ask you about, I mean, another hard, so North Korea is one hard problem. Let me ask you about some of the other hard problems that, I mean, you do talk about in the book, Iran. I mean, what's the use of hard power if we're thinking about Iran, I mean, which we could think about in terms of its potential nuclear weapons, which, you know, even if the present agreement holds, I mean, they'll get in some period of time, destabilization in the Middle East, support for global terrorism. What's the use of hard power with regard to Iran?
Well, again, I think there are parallels between the Iranian situation and the North Korean situation in that, I mean, it's the Iranian regime is quite different than the North Korean regime. It's in its own way more democratic, more open. And I use those terms pretty guardedly, but it is. Again, I would say hard power already plays a role in limiting what we're actually encountering. You have the Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf. You have American military alliances with the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, with Saudi Arabia. So I think, you know, I would argue that American military power, again, in that sort of silent way, has already contained some of it. Specifically with regard to the nuclear program, though, I think we are going to encounter, I think the nuclear agreement, most charitably understood, kicked the can down the road for 10 years. That's in the best case. And then the problem will resurface because the North Korea, the Iranians rather, really want nuclear weapons. And like the North Koreans, from a strategic, self-interested point of view, I can understand why. When I was at State, part of one of my portfolios was Iran, and I kept on my desk I think it was a 50,000 rial note, inflated currency, and it was a piece of Iranian currency that I picked up in Dubai. And I would show it to people because, you know, a picture of Ayatollah Khomeini and, you know, a mosque or something like that. But if you picked it up and you held it up to the light, what you saw as the watermark was the conventional sign of an atom right over Natanz. Well, when you're watermarking your currency that way, it tells you something about the nature of your commitment. I think there again, the issue will arise. It'll be for a later administration. This administration is just going to have fastballs coming at it one after another, and they're not going to think about Iran because that's, except in the context of immediate regional security. I don't think they'll be thinking about the nuclear program. The issue that will then arise will be, will the Israelis be inclined to do something about it? Will we be inclined to do something about it, or will there be a kind of a North Korean-style accommodation to it? And I have no idea, and I think you can't even foresee what will be the right approach 10 years from now, because a lot will hinge on what the Iranian regime looks like 10 years from now. You know, we worry about Iranian nuclear weapons because of the nature of the Iranian regime. We don't worry about French nuclear weapons for perfectly good reasons. We do worry more about Pakistani nuclear weapons. We worry a lot less about Indian nuclear weapons. It's, you know, it is driven chiefly by our understanding of the regime that we're dealing with. And I don't think we can really predict what that regime will be like in 10 years.
So, but if the regime, I mean, looks a lot like what it looks like now, that's unimaginative, but probably the best prediction. I mean, and I think it's exactly right to say that they certainly have, you know, a high degree of interest in attaining nuclear weapons. Now, they might just go to the threshold of getting nuclear weapons, right, and be a month or 2 months away. What could we do?
Again, a lot would depend on a technical judgment. And I'm you know, again, I'll just say I've become really wary of people opining without actually being in the guts of military planning about what is feasible and what is not feasible. Because when you're talking about air power, I mean, I really did learn this by immersing myself in everything there was to know about the first Gulf War. There's a lot of really technical stuff. There are different kinds of bombs that are manufactured in different kinds of ways, and it can make all the difference in the world whether it's 10 feet of reinforced concrete or whether it's, you know, three layers of reinforced concrete with a little bit of rubble in between, and so on and so on and so forth. I do think that the big issue, there'll be a very interesting discussion between us and the Israelis at that point.
You think it's possible that the Israelis would act unilaterally?
Yes. Again, you know, I don't know what the Israelis would do, but I don't think we do either. The Israeli risk calculus will be very different than ours. So one of my favorite stories, I knew the Israeli defense attaché, went on to become the Israeli head of Israeli military intelligence, Amos Yadlin, who you probably know as well. He flew in the Osirak raid that destroyed the Iraqi nuclear reactor. And he was actually the second pilot. And when they were planning that operation, which, as it turned out, went perfectly, and they lost nobody, but they were told, don't expect to come back. That was the expectation. And so the other pilots said, and they picked Amos, who was the kind of the hottest pilot in the bunch, to go to the chief of staff and say, okay, we understand that, we'll do that, but can you tell us how long you think we will set back the Iraqi program for? And the answer that they got was 6 months to a year. Mm-hmm. Now, from an American planner's point of view, that would be a completely unacceptable, you know, cost-benefit analysis, 6 months to a year. And I think no chief of staff of the Air Force would be willing to sign off on that kind of operation. The Israeli calculus will be, if the Iranian regime is the same kind of regime, could very well be an existential kind of calculation. And then when you're talking existential, then it's different. And the Israeli style and tactics and so on would also, I think, be very different. So we don't know. I keep on pleading ignorance. It's always safe.
Right. All right. Let me ask you, an easier question before I come back to the harder ones about ungoverned spaces and Islamic jihadism. All right, the easier one, but it's not so easy, does seem to be China. You know, easier in the sense that when we think about China, I mean, it seems easier there to think about a conventional military balance. But it seems to me, I mean, what China's done, at least over the last several years, and maybe beyond that, I mean, they've made this assertion of sovereignty over the South China Sea with the Nine Dash Line. They've constructed a bunch of islands, which are artificial, on reefs, which were underwater, totally or underwater part of the time. They've ignored this international arbitral court decision, which basically said that almost all of what they were doing was illegal. All right, and yet, it doesn't seem to me that we've done all that. They've declared these air defense identification zones based on their territorial claims. We seem to be mealy-mouthing our response to them. So I'll give you, you know, one example. I was actually at the Pacific Command in Honolulu 3 weeks ago. And the guy who's a four-star admiral in charge of the Pacific Fleet was saying, you know, the problem with the Chinese is that they're not professional, as if they were making a mistake by flying so close to our ships and planes, as opposed to threatening them. So that looks to me a place where conventional military force, it's easier to think about. We haven't done very much. Is that because our strategy's been bad or because, in fact, the balance of power is problematic for us or for some other reason?
I think the main reason is it took the United States government, under both Republicans and Democrats, a while to take the Chinese seriously as a military challenger. I mean, this goes back a long time. During the Clinton administration, I was on the a national security advisory panel in the National Intelligence Council. And I remember, even at the time, saying, wow, you know, you look at the trajectory of Chinese spending and the trajectory of the improvement in their forces, it's very impressive. And the answer is, well, yeah, but most of their airplanes are junk and so on and so forth. And it's really only in the last few years that people now look at the Chinese and they look at the quality of the technology they have. They look at the various reforms that the military keeps on being put through and they take them seriously. We've had a particular problem, I would argue, in the last, you know, without being wanting to be too partisan about it, particularly as a result of sequester, but in general, we have been underspending on the United States Navy. I mean, the obvious answer to this is a number of different forms of naval spending, submarines in particular, long-range strike aviation as well. And we have not been willing to spend the money on that. And that's partly because a lot of money has been spent on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Part of it is the result of sequester, which really has to do with American domestic politics. But that's, you know, on the material side, the answer is pretty clear, I think, which is, you know, you're going to need a lot more gray hulls. And we know how to do that. I think the situation is a little bit better than you might think, because what the Chinese have also done is they've actually strengthened the coalition against them. You know, I don't think the Japanese have really shown an inclination to lean in their direction, just the reverse. The Japanese have increased their own defense spending and are being they're willing to do more things than they used to. The Australians certainly haven't. The Philippines are an outlier because of the peculiar character of their president, quite peculiar. But other, you know, the Indians are stepping forward because they see a challenge from China. So I think from a broader geopolitical perspective, it's not an unmanageable problem. And if I could just dwell on that one for a moment. One of the reasons why I wrote the book for a number of reasons. One of them was that it seemed to me the discussion of military power had really gotten separated from the discussion of foreign policy. Different kinds of communities do defense analysis and foreign policy work. And so, for example, when you're analyzing the China problem, you know, the military types will immediately get down to, well, how many submarines and the range of the missiles and so forth. You need a broader perspective. The broader perspective is the nature of our alliance system in the Indo-Pacific and what kind of military power best supports that. Again, you know, essentially, this is a peaceful use of military power to avoid really catastrophic things from happening.
So if you project forward, I mean, without assigning probabilities, let's say the Chinese continue to grow economically. They're spending a lot of money on their defense infrastructure and on their military. In the end, is there any way they continue on their present trajectory, which I admit is the biggest, you know, just an assumption. I mean, could we do anything?
Well, I would say yes, and again, it's because I think there has to be a holistic analysis, which I try to do in a chapter in the book called The American Hand. And I think it is very important when you look at it, you don't just count up how many ships we have and all that. You know, would I prefer the American economy or the Chinese economy? I think I'd rather have the American economy. Would I rather have American demographics or Chinese demographics? I'd rather have American demographics. Would I rather have American ecological challenges or Chinese ecological challenges? No question about that one either. And I could continue on and on in terms of innovation, in terms of the depth of financial markets, and so on. So I think the American hand is actually pretty strong. I also think, you know, China is not Wilhelmine Germany. We could stumble into a war with China. That is a possibility. But I don't think the Chinese are bucking for one. And the Chinese actually have quite considerable vulnerabilities, which they're very sensitive to. They border on, I think, 14 different countries. They don't really have great relations with most of them. And, you know, this one is, in some ways, it's the biggest of all challenges, but it's also conceptually the easiest, I think, for us to cope with.
Okay, so we talked about, I mean, at least a couple of the problematic states. Yeah. We've talked about Iran. I mean, China. In some ways, I mean, the other two challenges you mentioned are ungoverned spaces and jihadis.
Yeah.
So how do we, if we're thinking about the jihadi threat, you know, is this really something that we can address with hard power, or is it really a kind of ideological war within Islam, I mean, which the U.S. might or might not be able to play a role in, but what's the role for hard power there?
So, of course, we haven't talked about Russia. You know, just enumerating these, I think, gives you a sense of the strategic challenges the United States government faces. And the basic argument of the book is this is manageable, but we have a much narrower margin to do it than we used to. And so there's a premium on adroit statecraft, which, depending on your view of the current administration, you may think we will get or you may think we won't get. And my views, I think, are pretty clear on that one. On the militant jihadi threat, you know, but part of what I talk about in the book is the need not only for military power in the sense of equipment and soldiers and whatnot. It's also, again, the software. And a large part of that is how do you think about it strategically? And I quote approvingly a remark made by the chief of the Australian Army, Peter Leahy, who said in an interview, we're in a 100-year war with radical Islam. Well, that's a very sobering thought. I taught at the Naval War College for a number of years, and basically we prepared the students to think strategically about wars lasting between 6 days and 6 years. We didn't really teach them how to think about a 100-year war. So I think the first thing is, what's the conceptual framework? And I think the framework is a very long-run conflict, which in a certain way actually takes some of the pressure off. You know, I think it's a mistake, for example, to say we're going to go in and we're going to eliminate the Islamic State. The desire to rack up wins on the board, or change the metaphor, to have scalps dangling at your belt can mislead you. I think so. The first thing you need is going to be a long-term patient effort. The nature of the military effort is going to be largely the things we're doing now, which is there is going to be a role for, I mean, to be blunt about it, killing people who need killing. And there is a role for American military assistance and advice to regimes that are fighting it. But it is going to be largely a soft, it in many respects, will be a soft power kind of conflict. Where our challenge is going to be, I mean, in a certain way, it's going to be limited because, you know, to the extent that this reflects things happening within Islamic states and within the Islamic world, there's just a limit on what we can do about it. So we can try to protect ourselves against it and contain it. There's a role for what we can do in terms of dividing these movements against one another, playing them off against one another and trying to disrupt them. There is a role for particularly helping countries which, you know, various kinds of de-radicalization movements. There's a role for clamping down on terrorist financing. We've actually, as you know, we've done an enormous amount in first in the Bush and then in the Obama administrations. But I think that the main thing to understand is this is like having a chronic illness. And in a certain way, the mistake that you would make is to try to get a cure by heroic measures. It's much more a question of the sustained use of various instruments of power, including military force, because at the end of the day, there will be some people that you really have to kill.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from the former Bush administration State Department official Elliot Cohen. He's now at Johns Hopkins University and is in conversation with Steve Krasner of Stanford University. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our moderator, Stephen Krasner.
Let me ask you some, not about specific areas, but, you know, we're now in the longest period of peace that's ever existed in the history of the modern state system. And there hasn't been an actual war among major powers since 1945. One standard explanation for this, which you're very familiar with, is the existence of nuclear weapons, which eliminated, I mean, both extremely costly and eliminated ambiguity about the actual consequences of a war. Why shouldn't we just rely on nuclear weapons? Why, when we're thinking about hard power, do we need other kinds of hard power, at least to defend our core interests, and maybe even beyond that?
Well, I'm all in favor of nuclear weapons, and we're not going to uninvent them. And I do think that they help preserve the peace during the Cold War. But if you were to ask me why have we had this long peace, I would say there are a number of reasons for it. One was that those nuclear weapons were possessed, together with conventional power, by two great states which were not contiguous, which were both essentially rational, which both had a long-term confidence because of their understanding of historical processes, which made them relaxed a little bit about what the long-term outcome of that conflict was going to be. And even so, as we now know, there were a number of times where things got quite dicey and where there were accidents and so forth. I don't think that that necessarily applies in the world that we're in now. I don't think that's how I would feel about it if I were an Indian looking at Pakistan. I don't think it's how I would think about it if I were an Israeli looking at Iran. I don't think it's how I would think about it if I were Japanese looking at North Korea. So I think the political context of nuclear weapons is very different, and I think of myself more as an historian now than as a political scientist, but I think people and political scientists in a curious way made a mistake by obsessing about the weapons and forgetting about the politics. Mm-hmm. Of the powers which possess them. You know, there is this argument that if everybody has nuclear weapons, Kenneth Waltz, of course, famously said, if you know everybody has nuclear weapons, you're like a bunch of people with very severe arthritis jammed in a really small room. You know, it's nobody's going to jostle anybody else because it's just too painful. And therefore, everybody should have nuclear weapons, and that would be a good thing. And, you know, my basic response to that is, if you want to live in a political science field experiment, fine, but I don't want to live in a political science field experiment. And again, I basically have a dark view of things, most things, not all things. And because I do believe in human folly and mistake and error and accident, I just don't think that's safe. I'll add one more thing, and that is I also think something that helped keep the peace was the living memory of World War II. And we are now beyond the living memory of World War II. And that's one thing that troubles me. I think our idea of disaster is 9/11, and not in any way minimizing the loss of life on 9/11. That's not real disaster. You know, that's not disaster as my parents' generation, let alone my grandparents' generation, understood it. And for us, that's all very remote, and we lack that sort of visceral awareness that, yeah, that could happen. Something like that could happen to us.
All right, so I'm going to try to turn to your questions, and excuse me, I'll try and summarize them if I can. So, I mean, there are several questions about the Iraq War. One about the Iraq War in general. I mean, and, you know, wasn't this really a disaster? And we could add, there are a bunch of other things we've done with hard power. The war in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, even the Korean War, Vietnam, which don't look like they've gone that well. So talk a little bit about, I mean, how you understand the Iraqi war, and then a specific, and I think very interesting question that someone has asked from the audience is, what do you think would happen if we actually armed the Syrian Kurds? You know, what kind of reaction would there be from Turkey? You know, is this something, is this really a policy option for us? So Iraq in general? And then this question about, I mean, what do we do with the Kurds?
So could I change that to a question about first Iraq and then Syria? And let me begin by suggesting the following. When they put up a tombstone for the foreign policy of the George W. Bush administration, there'll be a whole bunch of things written on that tombstone. But at the top of that tombstone, it written in capital letters, will be the word Iraq. When they put up the tombstone for the Obama administration's foreign policy, there'll be a whole bunch of things written on that tombstone. But at the top of that tombstone, in capital letters, will be the word Syria. And I think those two opposing stories really illuminate what's our predicament as we think of the use of military power. The decision to use force in one case, some people would call it catastrophe. The failure to use it in another place, some people would call that catastrophe as well. And even though it's not an interstate war, it has cost maybe 600,000 lives, 11 million refugees, you know, all kinds of things. So that's a first observation. Second observation is, okay, just to go to Iraq. I have a chapter in the book, as you know, called 15 Years of War, because I don't think you can talk about military power in American foreign policy without talking about Iraq. That was the hardest chapter to write for several reasons. One, I was in favor of the Iraq War, and I was engaged in a variety of ways in the periphery of some of the decision-making until 2007 when I came into the government. And then there's a personal angle, which is I have a son who's an Iraq veteran who had a couple of tours there with a light infantry unit. And, you know, when you're personally engaged in war, it changes things. Whether it's a family member or it's yourself, it's going to affect how you think about things. So my basic take on Iraq was, as I say in the book, that I think it was a mistake. I think it was the scope of the mistake, you can argue. I mean, it was a mistake in that, you know, they're part of the, obviously a key piece of the argument for it was the nuclear program, the Iraqi nuclear program. And it turns out the Iraqi nuclear program, you know, at that point was dead, although it's also quite clear that Saddam intended to revive it if and when he got a chance. I think there's a range of mistakes going beyond the initial decision, and that includes partly how we waged it. On the other hand, and I can say more about that if people are interested. On the other hand, what I would also say is, I think by the end of the Bush administration, when I was going to Iraq, I was going to Iraq quite regularly throughout this period, my feeling about the situation on the ground, and this was not just my view, it was the view of people like Ryan Crocker, a great American diplomat, Jim Jeffrey, another one, was that actually Iraq, by the end of 2008, was on a fragile trajectory to success. That is to say, the different groups were doing something that looked like politics. Oil was flowing, so you could basically buy off the different groups. It was sort of Chicago corruption, Baghdad style. And I was not deeply pessimistic about Iraq's predicament at the end of 2008. In fact, I was cautiously optimistic, as was the Obama administration for the first several years there. And you can go back and look at some of Vice President Biden's statements in particular. So I don't think it had to be as bad as it now is. And we still don't know what the end of the Iraqi story will be. I also think that we're going to have to be very careful how we invoke the Iraq case. You know, there's, I'm sure you remember David Halberstam's wonderful book, The Best and the Brightest. And he begins the book with McGeorge Bundy giving a lecture about the lessons of Munich, you know, which carry over to Vietnam. You know, people can invoke the Vietnam case, they can invoke Iraq, they will also invoke Syria. And I think the way we learn from history is by absorbing a lot of it and not saying, well, this particular case proves anything in particular, because it never does. To Syria, the particular question, we're going to find out, because apparently the administration has decided to arm the Syrian Kurds. I guess I would say the first, one of my criticisms of the Trump administration would be that I think they are seeing all this through the prism of a perceived necessity to destroy the Islamic State. And they are focused on that just about to the exclusion of everything else. And the problem is it is such a complicated set of circumstances that it's a mistake to look for that sort of decisive victory over one actor if in the process you then ignite the next round of wars.
All right, so this is a question from an aspiring SAIS student. I can't resist asking this. Then.
Outstanding.
Do you think there is a significant, potentially increasingly damaging disconnect in our country between the majority of our civilian population and our military cadets, officers, and other staff? I mean, we know that, you know, the best predictor of whether you're in the military is whether one of your parents have been in the military. But there's also a larger issue which you touch on in the book, which is that, you know, our government has a lot of specialists, but integrating them is very difficult. So you talk in the book a bit about engaging civilian expertise in the military, even potentially giving people military commissions.
Yep.
Do you think that's feasible? But, I mean, there is this large generic question about whether or not we've created this great military, but the military seems very disconnected with the rest of the country.
The larger thing is this. We have a professional military. It's an all-volunteer military, largely long service. There is no way we're going to change that. We're not going to have a draft. There are legal problems at this point with a national service draft, I would argue. The military couldn't use the number of people it would generate. It would be grossly unfair if we said, you don't go, 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 you go. That's not going to be acceptable. But there are things you can do, and it would require effort on the part of all kinds of leaders, and it would go against the grain for quite a few. So what are some of those what are some of the things? Making sure that you have ROTC, active ROTC programs on elite, particularly on elite campuses. The military actually would prefer just to get a lot of Texas A&M cadets. You know, a huge university, good quality students, very pro-military, efficiencies of scale, right? You can have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, as opposed to having a small program at Harvard or Amherst or Reed or a whole bunch of other places, which is not efficient. It's not efficient, but it would be worth doing. I think when everybody's always clamoring for a rational basing system. I'm in favor of an irrational basing system, or at least a basing system which takes into account American domestic politics. So I'm originally from New England. I'm a Bostonian. The last active duty military base in New England was Fort Devens, where I trained as an ROTC cadet. It's now just purely a National Guard reserve facility. Again, the military would prefer to have really big mega bases like Fort Benning and Fort Hood and all that. I would like to see the military in San Francisco, as it's been for many, many years in our history, so that average Americans are, you know, living side by side with military people, getting to know them, you know, people being what people are, they'd get married, so that the military is a presence in the country. So I think there are a number of measures that you can take to help ease that disconnect. And I agree, it is a substantial problem. And it's a substantial problem, by the way, partly because people won't care, but also partly because you can end up putting the military on a pedestal. You know, my parents' generation, you know, all the guys have been drafted, and they understood the warts in the military as well as the things that are very impressive and indeed noble about it.
There are some questions about Russia. And a specific question, I mean, here is it possible to bring Russia to a real negotiating position without starting a large-scale war? But, I mean, we could ask this whole specific set of questions about Russia. I mean, is there any mechanism where they could return Crimea to the Ukraine? Could you get them to leave the eastern Ukraine? Could you get them to alter basically setting up these autonomous areas in Georgia? Could you get them to make some kind of commitment not to invade the Baltic countries? That's the other big bad actor we didn't talk about. China's one, Russia's the other. What are the hard and soft power options that we have with regard to Russia?
Well, I think until the Russian regime changes in a pretty substantial way, which it may, because there are people, I have Russian friends who are Russianists who think that that regime is headed for a quite substantial crisis sometime in the next 5 to 15 years, and I can believe that. I can imagine, you know, with a different kind of Russia, lots and lots of things are possible. With the Russia of Vladimir Putin, and it's not just Putin personally, but it's the whole cadre of people around him and probably the kinds of people who will succeed him, you know, obviously you have to conduct negotiations, and you will conduct negotiations, and you may even have agreements here and there, but I think it is basically going to be a conflictual relationship. I don't see them returning Crimea actually ever. Withdrawing from eastern Ukraine, I think quite unlikely. Guarantees, well, they made a guarantee of Ukraine's border in the Budapest Agreement in 1994, and look what that bought us. But I think more deeply that, you know, the nature of the Russian pathology is that people like Putin and Lavrov, these were the people who had been grown to be the centurions of a great empire. And then suddenly that empire dissolved. They don't see that empire as having dissolved simply because of the internal crises of the Soviet Union. They think it was a result of external pressures, and to some extent they are right. There is an argument that you can make along those lines. There's just a level of resentment and bitterness, which I think is going to be hard to to talk them out of. They have their interpretation of the recent past, which I think is false, but they hold to it, which is, we're just doing what you people have been doing to us. So, you know, the way they interpret the color revolutions, as you know, is that this was a Western plot, and we're just, all this stuff about hybrid warfare and so on, this is what you guys are the masters of. We're going to school on you. And you really see this in Russian military writings. And beyond that, I think my view of Putin is that there are two things that are going on here. One is his great Russian nationalism and his projection of power, including in Syria and beyond, is partly his idea of Russian greatness, and it's partly a diversion from domestic things. But he will continue that. The second thing that I think is going on is more deeply than that. So the Putin generation of Russian officials certainly accept the end of the Cold War. They pretty much accept the end of the Warsaw Pact, and up to a point can accept the dissolution of the Soviet Union. What sticks in their craw is the persistence of NATO and the persistence of an American military presence in Europe. And I think that deep down, maybe not even so deep down, what they would really like to see happen is the effective dissolution of NATO. And that could happen, you know. At the moment, the president says NATO is not obsolete. You know, a couple months ago, NATO was obsolete. NATO may revert to obsolescence before you know it. And beyond that, there are deeper problems. So, you know, the Baltic states are members of NATO. They're covered by Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty. An attack against one is an attack against all. And yet there was a poll done in Germany not long ago where people were asked, you know, would you be willing to use military force to defend the Baltic states in the event of a Russian attack? And 70% of the German public said no. And I think one of the things you have to be concerned about is that we'll wake up someday and there are little green men in Latvia, and it's sort of ambiguous, and the Latvian president invokes Article 5, and Germany basically says, was ist das Article 5? Wir haben nie gehört von Article 5. You know, and then you have a real problem.
So, do you think we have a real problem even now? If we're thinking about the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, have we used hard power effectively?
I'll revert to my main point that often the most effective use of hard power is that some of the things it's prevented. I will give the Obama administration, which I was pretty critical of, although it's kind of mild by comparison with the things I've said about Trump. I will give them credit for having reintroduced heavy forces into Europe. And, you know, we now have a much more robust rotational presence in Poland and in the Baltic states where American forces are exercising there. I personally would like to see American forces permanently deployed there because I think that is the ultimate deterrent. I don't think the Russians are still quite rational. I don't think they want war with us. But here, too, by the way, I think it's really important people understand that the Russia that you're dealing with today and the Russian military of today, this is not the Russian military of 10 or even 5 years ago. It is a much more formidable force. As they have so often in their past, the Russians have gone from having a military that was a disaster to having a military that is actually in some ways very, very effective.
But do you think, if you look at the present moment, even though we've increased our presence in Eastern Europe, including the Baltic states, is it adequate? If you were Putin, wouldn't you think, if you really want to dissolve NATO, maybe you don't do a completely explicit invasion of the Baltic states, but you have little green men, you undermine what are really pretty impressive democratic regimes in those countries. You know that the Germans aren't going to fight. The rest of, Eastern Europe doesn't have the wherewithal to fight. The French are not going to send troops across Germany. So why, if you're Putin, if we're thinking about deterring an attack, either overt or covert in the Baltics, are we actually acting in the most appropriate ways now?
Well, a couple of responses. First, this is why I'd like to see American rather more substantial forces there and permanently deployed. As you know, during the Cold War, Berlin, of course, was completely cut off by East Germany. And there was a kind of elite American unit called the Berlin Brigade that was stationed in Berlin, which was actually quite large. It was a force of about 10,000 troops. It was actually considerably larger than a standard infantry brigade, and it was an elite assignment if you were an American infantryman, but 10,000 Americans. And they knew what their job was. Their job was to really go down swinging and to make the Russians pay to take Berlin. And it was very important that it was a substantial force. That, I think, was a deterrent. Let me move to a different war. You look at the Falklands War. So the British actually had some troops in the Falklands. They had 25 Marines. And the Argentines just kind of breezed by them. If instead of 25 it had been 250, I'm not even sure whether the Argentines would have attacked. And for sure, if it had been 2,000, even if they thought they could do it, they wouldn't have, because they know, well, boy, that's going to be a big shooting war that we're going to be in. So that's why the quantity matters. The other thing, by the way, that's interesting about the Falklands is when you look at the public opinion polling, when the British sent the flotilla, the majority of British opinion was against actually using it. They were in favor of sending it, but they were not in favor of an amphibious operation to retake the Falklands by force. Of course, you know, in the upshot, that's what the government did, and what ended up being a popularly supported war. I think in the same way that, yeah, if you ask as a hypothetical to the German population today, what would they say? They might say no. In an actual crisis, the answer might be different. And above all, I would say, once again, the critical variable is American leadership. You know, what would be critical in that kind of crisis would be, how is the American president viewed? Will people listen to him or to her? Will they exercise the moral authority as well as the political and military power of the United States? And that moral authority is really, really important.
Let me ask, so there are a couple of questions here that are more generic about new technology. So artificial intelligence, cybersecurity. So is the future making us, I mean, we could say, is the future making us relatively stronger or relatively weaker? Should we embrace these changes? I mean, we might have to embrace them, but is it leaving us more vulnerable, or actually can it be making us more secure?
I don't think you can really generalize about the direction, about how whether technology makes us more or less secure. I mean, you couldn't have had the Russian DNC hacks, you know, in a past era. Although, of course, you know, we did get into World War I in part because the British were decrypting German telegrams and decided to dump all that stuff into the American press, which was only too willing to print them. So, you know, it's not the first time that people have used intercepted communications to have an effect. I guess my basic belief is you can't stop technology. But more importantly, I think the United States in the long run benefits from technology, partly because, you know, we are a highly technological civilization. And also to the extent that what these technologies, I think the critical question is this: to the extent that technologies end up really empowering individuals and making spontaneous decision making throughout a huge organization all the way down effective, it benefits us. To the extent that you have technologies which allow countries that can't really trust sort of lower level operators to do things and really would prefer one person just flipping switches in some command post in Pyongyang or Beijing or whatever, it disadvantages us.
All right. So I'm sorry we didn't get to all of your questions. Thanks so much for spending this time with us. That
Steve,
was great.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Do visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Elliot Cohen. He's Director of Strategic Studies at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And he's in conversation with Stephen Krasner, Senior Fellow at the Freeman Spoley Institute at Stanford University. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Jane Heaven. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.